Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, gather around the radio. It's time for another installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. My name is Michael Harrison. It's my privilege to serve as anchor of the show. It's an ensemble show with lots of good people involved, and its host and founder is Carol Marks. Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues, and she's a champion in the battle against ageism. And on today's program, she'll be talking with Dr. Bill Thomas, an internationally recognized expert on aging, who was voted by the Wall Street Journal as one of the top 10 Americans shaping aging in the 21st century. And he and Carol are going to talk about his new book titled Second Wind, Navigating the Passage to a Slower, Deeper, and More Connected Life. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Now, let's jump right into the program, and here is Carol Marks in conversation in this segment with Mary Rockefeller Morgan. She's the daughter of former New York State Governor Nelson A. Rockefeller, and she lectures on the subject of twin loss. And she leads a bereavement group for those whose twin died in the 9/11 World Trade Center disaster. She's going to talk to Carol about her new book titled When Grief Calls Forth the Healing, a memoir of losing a twin. It's published by St. Asaph's Press.
Does a terrible loss matter if they're fraternal or identical? Is it less? And here's what really amazed me. When do twins first bond?
Well, first of all, fraternal versus identical twins. The thing is that what was so amazing for me was that in my life, being a fraternal twin and a girl-boy twin, in those days they really felt that that was like being an ersatz twin, that you were really genetically the same as a brother and sister. And they didn't understand the great bond that begins in the womb. So we can just go right to the next part of your question, which is the twin bond. And the twin bond begins in the womb from the moment of conception and really hasn't got anything to do with whether you're fraternal or identical, because there are two little tiny, tiny beings, moving and growing into fetuses and then into two babies. And they are born from their cellular structure. They're born they grow in connection. And the fascinating thing is that there have been sonogram studies that show that these little fetuses are actually reaching out to each other in intentional connection by the time they're 14 weeks of age.
That's unbelievable.
Actually, 3.5 months.
Really,
isn't that
really
amazing?
Something. Yes, it surely
so
is.
They are bonded. They are deeply bonded, and they're bonded in that essential 9 months. And then, of course, it depends a lot on what happens after they are born and how they are related to by their parents. And if they're seen as twins and mainly as being connected as almost like one, then their relationship is going to be even more deeply connected. If they're given a chance to, to develop an individual identity in an easier way, if they're given a chance to have experiences on their own without, of course, pulling them apart, which is not good either, then they have a chance to have more of a sense of themselves as individuals as they grow up. But identity is an enormous issue for twins. And, it's fascinating because one of the things that I found out in writing this book was that twin loss really magnifies the issues of deep personal loss. And identity can be an enormous issue in deep personal loss for everybody. I mean, you can have, for instance, a mother. I had a mother who lost her only child, and she literally did not want to go on with her life because she saw herself only as a mother, and she just felt that she had lost the whole meaning that she had in her life. I treated twin brothers also, they weren't twins, but were born very close in age, and they were very separated from the rest of their siblings who were much older. They grew up almost like twins. One of them died, and the other one went into a deep depression and didn't even want to apply to college, said he didn't have any sense of where he wanted to go if he couldn't talk to his brother about it.
Now, one of the things, don't you think, that has to do with how people handle the loss of a twin or the loss of somebody that they really care about very deeply is how others in the family handle it. And you really didn't speak about your loss for 27 years, and you said that your mother had a lot to do with that.
Yeah, one of the very, very sad things is when I lost my twin in New Guinea. He was lost off the southern coast of New Guinea and presumed to have drowned, although nobody has really any idea specifically how he has died. There's no physical evidence. So we've had no closure in our family, and despite all the stories that are still going around about his death, there is no evidence. So that we don't know about that. And when I got home, I went over there to New Guinea with my father to search for Michael. And when I came home, I was in a state of complete numbness. And when I got home, I saw my mother, and all I wanted to do was to hug her and to have her hold me, and we would cry. And she said to me, "Mary, the one thing we cannot do is cry. We have to get a hold of ourselves. We have to deal with this, and we cannot cry." And that was the saddest and most mistaken thing. And she did that out of love. That's the thing that so even makes it more sad. And in those days, in the 60s, people still weren't talking about grief. But today, Carol, I mean, we are so afraid of grief still in
absolutely
life, yeah. And we're afraid of death, and we make no safe place for our grief. And what my book, it's called "When Grief Calls Forth the Healing." It's really true because it is the grieving that calls forth the healing for us and brings the healing. And it is in grieving, in expressing the feelings of our grief in some way. Now, what I learned is that people have all different ways of expressing grief. And some do that with crying. Other people can do that if they write. I just saw a program which talked about young people who were expressing their grief in poetry. And these were people from backgrounds of poverty that really didn't know how to express in words anything, but they were able to write their feelings, and they turned into their own kind of poems, and this has been an amazing healing process for them.
That I wanted to ask you about was I thought was so meaningful in your memoir, and I just thought it makes so much sense. You said that we have a natural grieving process.
Yes.
And I never thought about it till you mentioned it, and you likened it to cutting your hand. So can you really go into that a little bit?
Well, thank you for reminding me of that, because it's so true, because we all know, we take for granted that if we cut ourselves, that the wound immediately begins to heal, that our systems in our body start to activate, and that wound begins to heal all on its own, due to this natural inner healing, physical inner healing process. Well, I believe we absolutely have the same thing psychologically. That when somebody dies, immediately this healing process begins, and it begins with a numbness because we are not able to face what's happened to us. So the body protects our mind. Our psyche protects itself by bringing this numbness, and people can go right through their funerals and all of this, and then slowly the grief starts to present itself. That's when my mother, of course, told me not to cry. And that grieving then brings the healing forth, and it does that in terms of feelings and memories. And it's so important to express those, as I said, in some form. And we can do that in therapy. We can do that. Some people do that in dance. My husband told me that the way he had experienced and expressed and healed from the death of his brother, actually, who was very close to him, was that he did that when he ran, that in running he could face the feelings of the grief when he couldn't otherwise. So we each have our special way, but if we do this, then what happens is that the relationship, which has been a physical connection, that begins to let go because it's not present anymore. And what it comes in its place is that whole realm of experience, which is the basic relationship that we've had to that person coming from the moments that we've experienced from them. And the grieving prepares our hearts to receive that relationship, which stays with us for the rest of our lives, and the love too. So if we allow the grieving and take time for it, then the relationship can transform and be present for us as a nurturing experience for us. And that happened to me, and I talk about that in When Grief Calls Forth the Healing, and how that manifested for me after 27 long years of denial.
That's Mary Rockefeller Morgan in conversation with Carol Marks. Her book is titled When Grief Calls Forth the Healing, A Memoir of Losing a Twin. It's published by St. Asaph's Press. Carol Marks talks with Dr. Bill Thomas, one of the leading experts in the world on aging. That's next. When A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups, continues in a moment.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security web pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said, you are the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps, so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best. So take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Continuing now with A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and here again is the host, Carol Marks, in conversation with Dr. Bill Thomas, internationally recognized expert on aging. He was voted by the Wall Street Journal as one of the top 10 Americans shaping aging in the 21st century. His new book is titled Second Wind, Navigating the Passage to a Slower, Deeper, and More Connected Life, published by Simon & Schuster.
What made you say that this generation has been indoctrinated with a shame-based approach to aging? And what role has the media played in this?
Well, you know, we're living right now in what I would call sort of the afterglow of the youth of the baby boom generation. And what really happened after World War II, with this enormous generation of people being born, is that this baby boom generation had the audacity to sort of define the culture around them. And so for a long time, we've been living with this idea that youth is best, that the virtues of youth are the most important virtues. And it's been this way for so long, we've kind of forgotten that there are actually other virtues and other values that are equally, if not more important.
And that, you know, that says it all in a nutshell. Now, why do you say it's so important for this generation of baby boomers to realize that they're going to be leaving adulthood and entering a new stage? And why do you think it's going to be a struggle for so many of us to outgrow adulthood?
Well, you know, it's hard to grow and it's hard to develop when you don't have an idea of what lies ahead. And if you just take this for a minute, any child in America is able to sort of understand and describe the basic contours of adulthood. Every child knows basically what adulthood is about. And virtually no adults in American society understand elderhood or appreciate or value elderhood as the next developmental destination. So what we have here is an alarming problem, which is, you know, 70 million people who wake up one day older every single day, one day closer to the end of adulthood, and they don't know what's next. They don't even have an idea that there is a next. And we're heading for a pretty amazing cultural upheaval as the post-war generation tries to figure out how to leave adulthood.
Well, one of the things, Dr. Bill Thomas, that I think is so helpful about your book and talking about, you know, what the next stage after adulthood is going to be like, you've kind of provided some guidance by defining three unique subcultures that are probably going to arise. And so I thought we'd talk about each of them. The first one is the denialist. What are all those about?
Well, you know, this is, I spent some time trying to figure out how do people in the post-war generation, how are they dealing with this kind of the end of adulthood? What are their strategies? And, the first group I was able to identify, they're pretty obvious actually, are the denialists. And those are the people who, just don't want to get older and they don't want to age and they want to be young and, they're pretty much willing to deny reality and try anything they can to create the illusion of youth. And this subculture ranges from very, very, you know, minor things, cosmetics and hair coloring, which is, you know, pretty common and normal, to very extreme measures where people actually have so much surgery done that they're barely recognizable as themselves. So the denialists just figure they're going to be the first people in the history of the world not to grow old. Then, if you don't mind, the second group, or what I call the realists, and they know that aging is happening. They don't like it, and they do everything they can to resist it. You know, they fiber and flaxseed and do crossword puzzles and go walking, but they don't see any value or virtue in aging. And then thirdly, and I'd love to kind of compare and contrast these with you. Thirdly, there's this small, crazy group of people who think that aging is a pretty cool endeavor. They believe that aging is the next great developmental challenge,
they've, you know, done adulthood. Adulthood was fine. Now they want to explore elderhood. And those are the people I call the enthusiasts.
Now, can I ask you one question?
Sure.
And that is because in reading your book, I learned that the largest subculture was the realist. And,
yeah,
of course, the one that I identify with and I think is great are the enthusiasts. Why aren't there more of them? I mean, why aren't they the largest?
You know, here's the problem that the enthusiasts run into is that a lot of people just can't even believe that they're not afraid of aging. That people have a hard time just believing that there's a group of people out there who actually celebrate their aging selves. So I'm a big fan and a big proponent of going out and declaring yourself to be an enthusiast. And in fact, this spring I'm going to be all across America, traveling across America, doing a performance called the Second Wind Tour, where we're going to be rallying enthusiasts and helping them find their voice and become part of the conversation.
And talking about the next stage, which we call elderhood, what are some of its advantages that you're going to be talking about?
Well, one of the biggest advantages is actually giving yourself permission to live in a new and different way. In the book, I write about the way that our culture uses the word still to sort of dismiss and demean older people. And everybody's heard this. Everybody's familiar with it. If you say, my aunt is 86 years old, and she still drives her car. Or my uncle is 90, and he still works every day. What we're saying to people is, you're valuable and you're admirable because you haven't changed, because you live the same way and do the same things you used to do. And there's no other part of human development where we use that kind of language. You don't say about a 15-year-old girl, oh, my daughter, she still drinks from a bottle. You know?
True.
That sounds
very true.
Terrible. So what I'm after is a new way of living beyond adulthood that has its own virtues and its own values and doesn't rely on adulthood and the life stage of adulthood for its inspiration.
That's Dr. Bill Thomas in conversation with Carol Marx. His book is titled Second Wind, Navigating the Passage to a Slower, Deeper, and More Connected Life. It's published by Simon & Schuster. And for free tickets, go to secondwindtour.org. I'm Michael Harrison. A Touch of Grey continues in a moment.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on matchingdonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. Matchingdonors.com improves those odds by finding living altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to matchingdonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's matchingdonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security web pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
This is a Driving Today Minute. Even though high gasoline prices have moderated somewhat, they're still quite high. It just makes good sense to do what you can do to reduce your fuel costs. The Alliance to Save Energy suggests a few easy things you can do.
Keep your car properly tuned up and change the air filter regularly, both to save gas and protect your engine. Curtail aggressive driving. According to the U.S. Department of Energy, speeding, rapid acceleration, and hard braking waste gas and curb mileage by as much as 33% at highway speeds.
So nix the jackrabbit starts and opt instead for slow acceleration from a dead stop. Slow down. The DOE says each mile per hour you drive over 60 is like paying an extra 10 cents per gallon. Inflate tires to the proper pressure. This will increase fuel economy and make tires safer and extend their life.
This Driving Today Minute is brought to you by Bridgestone Firestone Tires. You can get more information like this at drivingtoday.com or by visiting our partners such as autobytel.com, motorsportsforum.com, and more.
You're listening to A Touch of Gray. Check out our website at atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E. That's atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Engines.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to godirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do. And I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation's struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
If you plan to apply for Social Security disability benefits, there are things you can do to help speed up the usual 3 to 5 month wait for a decision. The more information you provide up front, the less time it'll take us to obtain the needed evidence, and the faster the decision can be made. Information like medical records or documentation, the names, addresses, and phone numbers of your doctors and medical facilities, information on your past employment, and more. To be prepared, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/disability and select Disability Starter Kits.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and we come to the point in the program where we peek behind the veil and we take a look at the world of talk media and talk radio, the kind of radio stations this program is heard on. And we're joined by our senior correspondent, Kevin Casey, who also is the vice president and executive editor at Talkers Magazine. Talkers Magazine is the leading trade publication that serves the talk radio industry. Kevin, baseball started this week, the official season, and I would say that of all the sports out there, the one that lends itself most, I would say, comfortably, accurately, directly to audio media, to radio, is baseball. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely, and you know, I guess there are a lot of different reasons why, and different people might have different reasons. I think it's great because it's something that you can listen to while doing something else. And just me personally, I find watching baseball on TV that isn't the playoffs to be ungodly boring.
Well, that's a problem baseball faces today in this sped-up world of the 21st century. And it's a big problem baseball has in terms of gathering younger fans for whom the slower pace of baseball is it goes against their natural tendency toward attention deficit disorder, which is a definite epidemic.
Oh, that's like, because I've been diagnosed, huh?
Well, I don't think you have it as much as people who are in their 20s and 30s do. I mean, this is a documented fact that attention spans are shorter for many reasons, and the pace of our life is quicker, and a lot of it is technologically induced. But baseball lends itself also because baseball, unlike some sports or other big sports, is usually one man and another guy in action. The pitcher throws the ball, the batter hits the ball. Whereas in basketball, hockey, and football, you really have to see what's going on to understand what's at play, because there's so many moving pieces. There's so many people moving. And baseball, you know, the camera can follow it, and the camera of the eye can follow it more accurately. I find when I'm driving in the car and I'm listening to a baseball game, I can actually see the game in my head as if I were watching it on TV. Talk about theater of the mind.
Sure.
But when you're listening to one of the other three sports, it really is just a way to keep on top of the score.
Yeah.
Am I right?
Well, you're right. I agree mostly, and I think that obviously it's easy to figure out that a person describing a baseball game, like you said, is really describing what one or two people are doing. Football, you got 22 guys on the field, and who can say, you know, he's going around the right end, and the left tackle just took a guy out on the other side. You know, no one can describe all of that action.
The one that I find the most difficult to follow is hockey. Hockey is probably the fastest sport in terms of team play, and the announcers are almost talking a code. It reminds me, if you're a real hockey fan, you probably can follow it, but it reminds me of listening to auctioneers. Am I right? You know, sold, you know, and it's like, blah, 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 score! And the scores come so seldom in hockey that, you know, when they do get a score, they all yell, score! At the top of their lungs. Kind of interesting. But this week was baseball opening week, kind of symbolizes the beginning of spring and summer and fresh hope, fresh cut grass.
Yeah, or
you know,
freshly removed snow.
You know, exactly. What was that story? Somebody broke their leg?
Yes, baseball great Don Baylor was catching the ceremonial pitch. And the pitch was a little outside. He made a jerky, quick movement to get out and catch it. And, you know, just one of those moments where you catch your leg in the wrong position. And he actually broke his leg catching this pitch and was collapsed at first at the home plate, rather. They tried to help him off, couldn't get up, and he had to be carted off. It was a very sad thing from a guy who, you know, great player for many years in Major League Baseball.
Horrible way to get injured. It was like the guy that broke his foot stepping on home plate after he hit a walk-off home run, the angel that did that. I don't remember who he was but at the moment, but that happened. And
There's always,
you know, the time that Gronkowski on the Patriots broke his leg defending a one-point field after point, you know,
the point after. I think of this all the time when I see guys celebrating in the end zone, especially in pro football, and I think, you know, if my guys came and jumped on me, I'd say, what are you doing? Don't we get hit enough? Why are you beating me up?
Terrible
now?
Way to get injured.
Many,
absolutely.
About 10 years ago or so, Heath Shuler, quarterback for the Washington Redskins, was celebrating a score. He went and did a little headbutt to the pads on the end zone and injured his neck and was out for a couple of games.
Oh, lovely. Head versus stadium. A stadium will always win. Thank you very much, Kevin Casey, who is the vice president and executive editor at Talkers Magazine, a trade publication and talk radio. If you want to know more about what's going on behind the scenes in the talk business, go to talkers.com. I'm Michael Harrison, and you're plugged into A Touch of Gray.
Did you know an estimated 16 million Americans suffer from a chronic inflammatory facial condition called rosacea? And most of them don't know it? Often mistaken for acne, there are many signs and symptoms of rosacea besides facial redness, pimples, and visible blood vessels. Other symptoms may include burning, stinging, swelling, and even enlargement of the nose. Rosacea can also affect the eyes, causing a bloodshot appearance and irritation that could lead to vision loss. Any one of these signs and symptoms can mean rosacea, and without medical help, it can become increasingly severe and wreak havoc on your personal and professional life. Rosacea typically appears any time after age 30. So if you experience any sign of rosacea, see a dermatologist for diagnosis and treatment. Or for more information, visit the National Rosacea Society at rosacea.org.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to GoDirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and it's time now to be joined the rest of this hour by our senior correspondent, Steve Wiseman, who will be interviewing Peter Simon. Now, Peter Simon is the brother of Carly Simon, an iconic rock and roll photographer in his own right. He has a new DVD of 50 years of work behind the camera called Through the Lens, a collection of 50 years of photography, along with honest discussion about his life.
When did you first start taking pictures?
I started really young. My father was an amateur photographer. He happened to be the co-founder of Simon & Schuster, the publisher, but was equally as interested in photography, but he couldn't make any money at it. But he at least showed me around his darkroom and how to use his camera. And I was maybe 10, 12 years old at the time. And then he passed away shortly thereafter, and I inherited all of his equipment. And I just felt it was in my legacy to keep shooting where he left off. So we're talking about the early 60s here. So that's when I started.
Did you always think of it as a career, or was this the kind of thing that you thought of like your dad did? You know, I don't know, you can make money out of this.
Well, fortunately, I have to say I was raised in a, you know, privileged environment, so that money wasn't the first motive for me. At least growing up, it wasn't. After I got into my adult years, I realized I didn't have that much money to live on because I wasn't left very much. So I did have to start making money, but at first it was just a hobby. Going through high school, it was a way of getting attention and acclaim amongst my classmates, who thought I was kind of nerdy and unathletic and not very intelligent. So at least I had an identity going through high school. But once I went to BU, I started, Boston University, that is, I started shooting for all the Boston media, including the Boston University newspaper. And then I started working for Rolling Stone, and that's when I started getting paid. And it seemed so exciting that I got paid for something I love to do. I thought, wow, this is a great lifestyle. So that's when I decided, even though it's a meager career money-wise, I mean, few photographers make six figures.
Yeah.
There are a few. But I did it for the love of it and wanting to contribute to society through my imagery.
You know, your timing is always important, and your timing to be a photographer and a chronicler of what's going on couldn't be better. I mean, you and I are about the same age, so you're at BU, Boston University, in the 1960s. This is a time of the tremendous protests, the war in Vietnam, the drug culture. So you had rich material. Where'd you point your camera first?
Well, it really started because I was working for, as I say, the college newspaper, which turned radical really quickly, like the Columbia University paper did. And I got very involved in, you know, left-wing politics. And I went to all the demonstrations. I went to all the be-ins, the love-ins, the trip-ins. And then the rock and roll started happening. And it started with the folk music in Cambridge, like Tom Rush and Ian and Sylvia. And then branched out to the Grateful Dead, the Byrds, and Dylan, and, you know, all the great rock and rollers that came through Boston in the late 60s. Then I started working for the Boston Underground, quote, paper called the Boston Phoenix, and then the Boston Globe. And I started taking pictures of things I loved and cared about, and then wound up selling them as well. So it was kind of a win-win.
You know, we're here talking on the radio, but I've seen your photographs, and they're magnificent, and many of them are really, they're iconic. Did you realize how iconic these images were going to be at the time when you're taking pictures of the Beatles or the Rolling Stones or events at protests?
Yeah, that's such an interesting question to ask, because at the time I knew something was happening, but I didn't know what it was. Did I? But no, I thought that it was an exciting moment in history. I mean, I could tell. But who knew where it was going, and who knew how it was going to last? And I just took pictures very much in the moment and wanted to see them published. And it was so exciting. I sort of kept thinking it was going to last forever, to be honest. I didn't realize how boring it would get after the late 80s. I just thought, I think our culture sort of went down the tubes. So you're right. I was there right on the cusp of the boomers wanting to change the world, let's put it that way.
Now, you have used all kinds of great cameras. What do you think about today, the fact that so many people are using their phones for cameras?
Well, it's certainly changed the playing field, and it's made the career opportunities for photographers even more limited, because anyone can send anything in of any event that happens before their eyes, some of which is newsworthy, like a car crash or a celebrity getting busted or whatever it may be. Someone's there with a cell camera, and then they can submit it to a newspaper or magazine, get paid maybe $50 for it. So it's really made it impossible to make money as a photojournalist. I feel sorry for those photographers who really think there's a world out there for them to support themselves with. Although, having said that, you can rise to the top and get known for a certain look, or go into fashion, or go into advertising, or wedding photography. But that's the kind of stuff that never really interested me.
Yeah.
It was always meaningful social change, cultural photography. So I think I'd be a poor man right now if I was starting out.
For someone who does love photography like you do, and actually use a real camera, what would be your best tips for them to consider?
Well, I use a Canon Rebel, which is not even one of the high-end cameras, but it's light. The main thing is the lens. The lens is the key, and it's very sharp. I find shooting with an iPhone really annoying. I don't like holding it up away from my face. It just seems odd.
It doesn't feel right.
And I can't compose the pictures right. It just feels foreign to me.
Mm-hmm.
For someone who wants to take photography seriously still, I would go with one of those digital SLRs, because at least you can change lenses, you can see more what you're getting, and it doesn't seem so automated. You have a little bit of control, and there's some creative processes that you can do with both formats, but I don't take iPhone photography as seriously as many other people do, I guess. But what I think the most important thing is how you visualize something and how you photograph it, the lighting, the composition, how you juxtapose subject matter, and what you're trying to say. I mean, I feel this DVD, now of course it's 50 years, but I feel it's a legacy. It's something I can say I really accomplished. I've photographed a time period that's unique in our culture, and people can really look at it and feel they're reliving. A lot of us boomers feel that we're reliving our lives through this DVD, and it's very exciting for me that.
It was for me as well, because, again, I shared the times with you and shared a lot of other experiences, and a lot of it brought back memories and smiles. However, one thing I do have to ask you about.
Yes.
The Mets? The Mets? I mean,
I
come on now, the Mets?
What yeah, but do?
Okay, at least you're not
a
Yankee.
I'm a fan, by the way, and
okay, that's
family
good.
Was very friendly with Jackie Robinson and family. And
also good.
But we hung out all the time with the Robinsons. They wound up living with us for a year while their house was being built in Connecticut. And it's in my blood. And, you know, as depressing as the Mets have been, they're almost, they're so pathetic now, but it's like an addiction that I can't get away from.
All right. Well, we're all allowed something. And actually, you were into the Mets when, boy, it wasn't cool to be into the Mets, was it?
Yeah, the early 60s, they were pathetic. And then we had our glory years, 1986, I'll never forget.
Neither will I. I'm a Red Sox fan.
More or less downhill ever since, but I still want, you know, if they have a horrible year towards the end of the year, I'll turn over and become a Red Sox fan.
That's Peter Simon talking about his new Through the Lens collection, photography and honest discussion about his life. Carly Simon's brother, a very well-known, iconic rock and roll photographer who has really chronicled the baby boomer generation. And that, of course, was conducted by Steve Wiseman. If you want to go for more information, go to petersimon.com. And Steve Wiseman will return in just a moment for our final segment discussing file and suspend strategy for Social Security. That's next when A Touch of Gray continues.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/MedicareOnly. That's socialsecurity.gov/MedicareOnly.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
She's conquered some of the most challenging ski courses anywhere, but with only one leg, the odds were against her even walking.
The growth was stunted in my right leg when I was born, and the doctors told my mother we needed to amputate when I was 5 years old.
Bonnie was helped at a Shriners Hospital, one of a network of 22 hospitals helping kids throughout North America. Shriners Hospitals provide world-class orthopedic and burn medical care, and they offer that care totally free of charge.
The care and treatment the Shriners gave me was a gift. It wasn't just about learning to walk. They helped me to believe in myself.
There's a Shriners Hospital helping kids from this area realize their dreams.
If I went back to the Shriners Hospital and talked to the nurses and doctors, I would say thank you. Thank you for making my dreams come true.
If you know a child they could help, call 1-800-237-5055. Shriners, giving help and hope to kids for over 80 years.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to GoDirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I prepare for our next mission.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. We come to the final segment of our hour broadcast. And it's time now for Steve Wiseman to share some of his expertise on stuff. He is an expert on a ton of things. He has written The Truth About Avoiding Scams, published by Prentice Hall. He has a website called Scamicide.com. And he's here now to share his knowledge about file and suspend strategy for Social Security. Steve?
Thank you, Michael. You know, you may have heard of a strategy used in Social Security called file and suspend. It really works very well and totally legal. This was something that was approved by Congress and signed into law back when Bill Clinton was president, part of the Senior Citizens Freedom to Work Act of 2000. And the idea at that time was to give people incentives to work longer by allowing them to work and receive full Social Security benefits after they've reached full retirement age. And the way this file and suspend strategy works is that you'll have, let's say you've got a couple, married couple, and let's say, as is commonly the situation, the man may have a higher Social Security benefit built up than his wife. So when it comes time for the husband to be able to apply for full Social Security benefits, and remember, if you apply early, and you can apply early at age 62, you're not going to get full benefits. You're going to get only 75% or so of the benefits you would get at full retirement age. Also, if you wait till 70 to file for retirement benefits under Social Security, you're going to get an 8% increase every year after your full age of retirement, which is like 66 and change for baby boomers. It was, being phased up to 67. So here's how the thing works. The husband files for Social Security at his full retirement age, but then he suspends it. And by suspending it, he's able to wait until full retirement age later, as late as 70, to be able to get that increased amount. But by filing and then suspending, it allows his wife to get a marital benefit, and that benefit is half of what his benefit would have been at that full retirement age. Now, I guess it sounds a little convoluted and it sounds a little confusing, but this technique, which is, like I say, entirely legal, is something that a lot of people have been doing. And are able to get substantial overall benefits, because the wife gets those benefits of the spousal benefits, and then when she gets to be full retirement age, she can switch over to her own. Works really well, but now the Obama administration is concerned about this, and it looks like they're going to be trying to take action against this in the next budget. So if you are someone to whom this could apply, you may want to take a look at it and talk with your financial advisor or your lawyer, because it's still a legal strategy and one that can help a lot of people.
Thank you, Steve Wiseman. Steve Wiseman, our senior correspondent and a regular feature here on A Touch of Gray. If you'd like to know more about Steve, go to scamaside.com, his website. It is an extraordinary bundle of information on the Internet. Also, he's written The Truth About Avoiding Scams, published by Prentice Hall. Thank you, Steve. And a thank you to Kevin Casey from Talkers Magazine. A huge thank you to Beverly Santanello, our producer on the front line. And thank you very much to Carol Marks, the host and founder of the program. On behalf of all of us, I'm Michael Harrison, inviting you to join us next weekend right here for another installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups.